Mrs. Wynne gave Robert a small, apologetic smile for her son's brusque behaviour, and taking advantage of this, he said, "Mrs. Wynne, if it ever occurs to you that anything in that story of Betty's doesn't ring true, I hope you won't decide that sleeping dogs are best left. You have a naturally analytical mind. Some day it may occur to you that this or that doesn't fit." To his surprise, something moved behind her eyes at this last remark. So, somewhere, there was a small thing that left a question in her mind. Then, in what he always remembered afterwards as a telepathic moment, he asked, "Had she anything in her pockets when she came home?"
"She only had one pocket. In her dress."
"And was there anything in it?" There was the faintest tightening round her mouth.
"Just a lipstick."
"A lipstick? She's a little young for that, isn't she?"
"My dear Mr. Blair, they start experimenting with lipstick at the age of 10.
"Yes, probably. Woolworth's is a great benefactor." As he turned onto the main Aylesbury-London road, Robert wondered what had puzzled her about the lipstick. Was it just the fact that the fiends at the franchise should have left it with the girl? Or was that what she found odd? Anyway, a lipstick that puzzled Mrs. Wynne could be added to the fact that the girl had a photographic memory, to the fact that her nose had been put out of joint without warning only a month or two ago by her adoptive brother's engagement, to the fact that she was bored with school, to the fact, above all, that no one in that household, not even detached, sensible Mrs. Wynne, knew what went on in Betty Kane's mind. It was quite unbelievable that a girl of 15, who had been the centre of a young man's world, could see herself supplanted overnight without reacting violently to the situation. But Betty had been very nice about it. Robert found this heartening. It was proof that that candid young face was no guide at all to the person who was Betty Kane. Robert had decided to kill several birds with one stone by spending the night in London. To begin with, what his old friend Kevin McDermott didn't know about crime was probably not worth knowing. And, as a well-known defending counsel, his knowledge of human nature was extensive and peculiar. Kevin kept a small flat in St. Paul's Churchyard, and whenever Robert was in town, they dined together. But first, Robert's search for the truth about Betty Kane brought him to the vacant space where that block of flats had been, where both her parents had died one night in the Blitz. It was a bare, neat space, waiting its appointed part in some plan. But on the opposite side of the street, a row of small shops still stood, as they had obviously stood for 50 years or more. Robert went into the tobacconist's. A tobacconist and newsagent knows everything. "Were you here when that happened?" Robert asked, nodding his head towards the door.
"Oh, yes," said the man. "Brought up in the neighbourhood, I was."
"Do you remember the Canes, by any chance?"
"Of course I do. They were in and out of this place all day. The bomb fell in the area there. That's how the Canes were killed. They were down in their basement. And the whole thing just settled down like a house of cards. Shocking."
He straightened the edge of a pile of evening papers.
"It was her bad luck that the only evening in weeks that she was home with her husband, a bomb had to come."
"Where was she usually, then? Did she work in the evenings?"
"Work?" said the man with vast scorn. "Her? More like having a good time. He wanted her to go away, to the country, with that little girl of theirs. But not her. 3 days of the country would kill her, she said. She didn't even go to see the little thing when they evacuated her. It's my opinion she was tickled to death to have the child off her hands so she could go dancing at nights."
"Whom did she go dancing with?"
"Officers," the man said succinctly. "A lot more exciting than watching the grass grow. I don't say there was any actual harm in it, mind you. But she was a bad mother, and a bad wife, that's flat, and no one ever said anything to the contrary."
"Was she pretty?"
"In a sulky sort of way, yes."
"And her husband?"
"He was all right. Deserved better luck than that woman. One of the best Bert was. Terribly fond of the little girl.
spoiler, of course. She had only to want something, and he got it for her. Demure she was. Butter wouldn't melt in her mouth. Yeah, Bert deserved better out of life than a good-time wife and a cupboard-love kid. One of the best Bert was. Robert went out into the street relieved. Betty Kane's mother was exactly the mother he would have chosen for her, and she, on her part, looked very like being her mother's daughter. A cupboard-love kid. And what was it Mrs. Wynne had said? She cried because she didn't like the food. I don't remember her crying for her mother. Nor for her father, who so devotedly spoiled her, apparently. Kevin's flat in St. Paul's Churchyard was a pleasant little place, warm and friendly and peaceful, now that the roar of the city traffic was still. Kevin, eyes pale and mocking under their black brows, sat down with his drink opposite Robert. I needn't ask if you're up here on business. I suppose you dash off again tomorrow after a 10 a.m. interview with someone's solicitors. No, Robert said. Scotland Yard. Kevin paused with his glass halfway to his mouth. What has the Yard to do with the ivory tower of Blair, Haywood and Bennett? That's just it, Robert said equably. I don't know how to deal with it, and I want to listen to someone being intelligent about the situation. He took out his copy of Betty Kane's statement to the police. I wish you would tell me how it strikes you. This is the Ack Emmer's protege, I take it. And your clients are the two women in the case, not this girl. Of course. Robert gave him the whole story. His reluctant visit to the franchise, his growing partisanship, as it became clear that it was a choice between Betty Kane and the two women. Scotland Yard's decision not to move on the available evidence, and Leslie Wynne's rash visit to the office of the Ack Emmer newspaper. So, tonight, McDermott said, the Yard is moving heaven and earth to find corroborative evidence that will back up the girl's story. What you want to know is, do I find it believable? And of course, I do. You do? Why not? But it's an absurd story. There's nothing absurd about it. Women who live lonely lives do insane things, especially if they are poor gentlewomen. And here are two lonely and badly dowered women, saddled with a big house in the country, one of them too old to do much household work, and the other loathing it. What is the most likely form for their mild insanity to take? The capture of a girl to be a servant, of course. Damn Kevin and his counsel's mind. Robert had thought he had wanted Kevin's opinion, but what he had really wanted was Kevin's backing for his own opinion. The girl they capture happens to be a blameless schoolgirl conveniently far from her home, Kevin went on. It is the Sharps' bad luck she is so blameless, because since she has never been caught out in a lie to date, everyone is going to take her word against theirs. If I were the police, I would have risked a case. It seems to me they're losing their nerve. He sat for a moment or two, enjoying his friend's discomfiture. Of course, he said at length, they may have remembered a parallel case where everybody believed the girl's heart-rending story and were thoroughly led up the garden. A parallel, Robert said, sitting up. When? 17-something. I forget the exact date. Oh, said Robert, dashed again. I don't know what is oh about it, McDermott said mildly. The nature of alibis hasn't changed much in 2 centuries. Alibis? If the parallel case is any guide, the girl's story is an alibi. Then you find it believable that the girl's story is nonsense? Of course. A complete invention from beginning to end. Kevin, you are maddening. Originally, you said you found the girl's story believable. So I do. I also find it believable that it is a tissue of lies. I can make a very good case out for either. But on the whole, I should prefer to be counsel for the young woman from Aylesbury. She would be wonderful in the witness box, and from what you tell me, neither of the Sharps would be much help, visually. He got up to help himself to more whiskey, holding out his other hand for Robert's glass. But Robert shook his head without lifting his gaze from the fire. He was tired and beginning to be out of temper with Kevin. When a man had been a counsel in the criminal courts as long as Kevin had, his mind had only points of view, not convictions any more. I wonder what she was doing all that month. Kevin said, conversationally. Scotland Yard, the next morning, in the person of Detective Inspector Grant, quite willingly agreed that Robert should be told about any letters that the Ackammers article on the case might provoke. "But don't pin your hopes to that, will you?" he said, in friendly warning. "For every letter the Yard gets that has any worth, it gets 5,000 that are nonsense." Still, Robert had come away satisfied. Now he was speeding down the Larborough Road on the way to seeing Betty's relations in Maneshill, the people she had stayed with on that memorable holiday when she had disappeared. A Mr. and Mrs. Tilsit, they were, of 93 Cheryl Street, Maneshill, Larborough. The husband was a travelling agent for a firm of brushmakers in Larborough, and they had no children. That was all Robert knew about them. As he turned off the main road in Maneshill, he remembered this was the corner where Betty Kane had waited for her bus, or said she waited. A busy enough road at this time of day, but empty enough, Robert supposed, in the doldrum hour of the late afternoon. When he had rung unavailingly at number 93, a woman flung up the bedroom window next door and said, "Are you looking for Mrs. Tilsit?" Robert said he was. "She's gone to get her groceries. The shop at the corner." "Oh, thanks. I'll wait." "I shouldn't. If you want to see her soon, she takes half a morning deciding between two brands of wheat flakes. I'd go and fetch her if I were you." Robert thanked her and had begun to walk away when she hailed him again. "You leave your car there for 10 minutes. You'll be looking to find the chassis. Take it with you." So Robert got obediently into the car and drove down to the grocer's. And as he drove, he remembered this was where Betty Kane had been so happy, this rather dreary, rather grimy street. So happy that she had written to say that she was staying on for the rest of her holidays. What had she found that was so desirable? He was still wondering as he walked into the grocer's. There was no need for any guesswork. There was only one woman in the shop, and one glance at the grocer's long, suffering face made it plain she was Mrs. Tilsit. Robert's heart sank. Mrs. Tilsit was one of those women whose minds are always on something else. They chat brightly with you, they agree with you, but their real attention is concentrated on what to do with the fish. Still, she seemed impressed with the appearance of Robert's car, and asked him in to have a cup of tea.